Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Norma Walden, Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum. We welcome our audience here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, Stephen Hill, is a political writer, a force for political reform, and the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. You probably noticed the book for sale in the entranceway, and he will be autographing copies immediately after the program. Mr. Hill's previous books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts with co-author Rob Ritchie. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and the San Francisco Chronicle, among many other publications. He is a graduate of Yale University. For a decade, Mr. Hill has traveled widely in Europe to understand the uniquely European way of life, including its response to the current economic crisis. Let's welcome Stephen Hill.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Great. Well, it's really a great pleasure to be here back at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to Norma for that gracious introduction and to share this evening with you as we consider where we've been and where we're going in this 21st century. There really couldn't be a better time to have this conversation because we've suffered an economic earthquake of about 8.0 on the Richter scale. And since that earthquake in October, thereabouts, of 2008, we have seen numerous aftershocks, Greece making a lot of headlines, California, of course, issuing IOUs to pay our debts, 25% of Californians with no health care, as one recent report said. Looking forward, a place like China, which some have seen as a bright spot in this economic crisis, actually, it's looking like they have a pretty massive property bubble, which should be familiar to us because bubbles pop eventually. And when they do, they create a lot of chaos, depending on how big that bubble is. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety out there about where is the United States going, where is the world going. And that spirit is which I wrote this book in order to sort of foment a discussion about what's the best model of development in the 21st century. The world is facing two enormous challenges. The first one is, how are we going to identify the institutions and practices that are going to allow a burgeoning global population of 6.5 billion people to enjoy a decent standard of living? Or another way of saying it is, how are we going to allow the Chinas and the Indias and the Brazils to come up in the world and enjoy, you know, have a seat at the table like we have? And how are we going to do that in a way that doesn't burn up the atmosphere and the planet in a Venus atmosphere of our own creation? Especially the advanced economies like the United States, Europe, Japan are going to be asked in the future from here on forward to do more with less. It's simply the case that we've been living in sort of the post-World War II period, in which the United States emerged as the dominant power of the post-World War II period. In fact, a lot of people like Paul Krugman right now are talking about the need for economic stimulus and pointing to, you know, the stimulus we did as a result of spending in World War II, massive amounts of government spending is what got our economy going again. That may have been part of it. But it's also the case that after World War II, virtually every other economic competitor had been wiped out. So we were the dominant power. That's no longer the case. The world has become what they call multipolar. There are lots of countries now that have great things about them, also their challenges, and we're still a very strong country. We have many things going for us, but it's simply the case that we are not the dominant power that we were in the post-World War II period. Instead of giving money to Germany and France and things like the Marshall Plan, in which we built up other nations, we're now a debtor nation. Starting during the Reagan administration, we became the largest debtor nation in the world. you know, there's all sorts of indicators around health care and inequality and all these sorts of things where we have fallen quite behind. In the last three decades, the American workers have been some of the most productive in the world. But the benefits of that productivity hasn't gone into the pockets of American workers. Instead, American workers have seen a pretty steady decline in income for the last three decades. Where has that money gone? It's gone into the pockets of basically corporations, businesses, the wealthy. So is that the right way for our economy to develop going forward? These are extremely important questions, not trivial matters at all. And, of course, all of them are subject to the political process and whether that works equitably and efficiently. So a key word that's going to be important going forward is the word productivity. Productivity in all sorts of areas. Productivity as a concept simply means sort of doing more with less. Can you get the, in terms of energy productivity, can you get the same amount of energy for using less fuel? In terms of labor productivity, can you get the same amount of output from your workforce given the same number of hours worked? Social productivity, can you get a quality of life for more people given the amount of wealth your society produces? In all these areas, the United States is going to have to step up its game in a fairly serious way. The outcomes we had in the post-World War II period, the inefficiencies that we had, are not going to work anymore because the world is much more competitive. And of course, all of the major capitalist economies, the United States, Europe, Japan, are basically grappling with the fact that much of our wealth production has been driven by deficit spending, running up huge debts. And is that sustainable? So these are all the questions that everybody's juggling. Even the great economists, people like Joseph Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, and reading their things on a regular basis, to be honest, I'm not sure anybody really knows what's going on. This is the other sort of ominous aspect of, to all of what we're standing in the middle of right now. You look at the history of economists over the last two decades. Remember in the early 90s when the economists told us that Japan was going to eat our lunch and we were going to have deficits as far as the eye could see? In fact, deficits gave Ross Perot his political rise. Remember Ross Perot? By the end of the 90s, we had a surplus as far as the eye could see. And Japan was undergoing what was then called the lost decade. Well, then, showing the schizophrenia of the economics profession, then you look at this so-called lost decade of Japan. They had 3% unemployment, universal health care. They had less inequality than we had in the United States. The United States should be so lucky as to have a Japan-style lost decade. And yet people like Paul Krugman have been prominent at basically saying that Japan's economy is a mess, even though in many ways Japan's economy is doing better than ours. It really raises fundamental questions about what we value and what we prioritize and how we measure the strengths of economies. And do the economists, keep in mind, the economic profession missed an $8 trillion housing bubble. How do you miss an $8 trillion housing bubble and call yourself an expert? These are the sorts of things that we're basically flying in the fog without radar, and our experts seem as one of my colleagues said, it's like having a cook who not only burned the meal but burned down the restaurant in the process, and yet the cook is still there cooking. The cook didn't lose his job or her job. How many economists lost their job over basically being so wrong for so long? So into this this environment, if you will, is where, in doing the research for this book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure World, is where I came to the conclusion that Europe certainly has its problems and challenges. But on the whole, it has the right values and the right institutions that have incorporated those values to allow it to do more with less. And that we in the United States need to get past our stereotypes about Europe, I'm sure many of you have been to Europe. How many people here? I bet a lot of you have heard the things that we hear about Europe. Let's just call them out. When you think of Europe, what comes to mind? Socialism.
The old world.
Cheese, good wine. How about their economy? Is it welfare state? You know, the economy is sclerotic, red tape strangling the businesses. Is one
6 weeks of vacation?
There's a seat up here for your maternity leave. So there's, I mean, we Americans already think we know quite a lot about Europe. And yet, when I first began traveling to Europe in the late 1990s to do some of this research, I had a lot of the similar ideas that Americans believe about Europe. And I came to discover that most of what I thought I knew about Europe was pretty wrong. The idea that Europe has a weak, slow-growth, sclerotic economy. Europe has the largest economy in the world. It produces nearly a third of the world's GDP. Europe's economy is almost as large as the United States and China combined. Europe has more Fortune 500 companies than the United States and China combined. Europe has more small. We think of the United States as the land of small business. You hear, you know, politicians all the time say, "Small businesses are the backbone of the American economy." Europe has more small businesses producing 2/3 of the jobs in Europe compared to fewer than half the jobs in the United States. If you invested your money in the European stock markets up until 2008, when everything crashed, on average, you made more money in the European stock markets than you made in the American stock market. American businesses invest far more money in Europe than they do in China. In fact, American businesses make 20 times the profit in Europe than they do in China. So, I mean, does this sound like a socialist economy? Does this sound like a place that's strangling and red tape, bureaucracy, all the myths and stereotypes that you hear about Europe? Absolutely not. And in fact, what I discovered is that Europe is not socialist at all. It's very capitalist. But it has a different type of capitalism than what we have here in the United States. And in my book, I call what Europe has social capitalism and what we have Wall Street capitalism. And the basic difference is that social capitalism has figured out how to harness the tremendous wealth creation power of a capitalist economy. Because there's no question that capitalism is the greatest wealth creator that humans have ever devised. But there's an outstanding question there. Who gets that wealth? Whose pockets does it go into? Europe has figured out how to harness this wealth to create a more broadly shared prosperity. Whereas in the United States, we have Wall Street capital that's basically meant shipping manufacturing jobs overseas, putting much more of our economy into the financial industry, which has grown astronomically since the Reagan administration, both in terms of percentage of GDP, percentage of corporate profits, and other ways that we measure these things. Our economy has become much more dependent on a different type of wealth creation. And our economy as a Wall Street capitalism is much more of a trickle-down economy, more than Europe is, which has this more broadly shared prosperity. And how does Europe create this more broadly shared prosperity? Well, they do it by plowing their money into things like healthcare, more generous retirement pensions, paid sick leave, paid parental leave, more generous vacations, child care, more senior care. These are the sorts of things that Europe has decided this is how you pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And now some people call this, you know, you'll hear American detractors saying, well, that's the nanny state or the welfare state. But one of the epiphanies I had was that, in fact, I was sitting on the Thames interviewing a British analyst. And, you know, Britain is a country that is considered kind of betwixt and between Europe and the United States. And he said, you know, this really is not welfare as you Americans understand that. Because welfare in the United States is not a very nice term. It means people kicking back on the dole, all these sorts of things. He said, it's really about how do you put support around families and individuals in a way that allows them to remain healthy and productive. It's about how you create a productive workforce. And Europe has a very productive workforce. That's how they've been able to create all this wealth, because they have such high labor productivity. And so in my book, I actually call it the workfare system. It's about working. It's not about welfare as we understand it. It's not about kicking back on the dole. It's about working. And that's what Europe has decided is the way to develop its economy. And so in many ways, what my book is, Europe's Promise, it's the story about how Europe in the post-World War II period converted itself from the military warring machines that it had been for centuries, right? I mean, they fought a lot of brutal, bloody wars for a long, long time. And after World War II, it was actually the conservative politicians of Europe, Konrad Adenauer for Germany, Robert Schuman from France, and Winston Churchill from Britain. It was the conservative politicians that said, you know what, we can't do this anymore. We have to figure out how to plow our wealth and resources into another type of economy. And so they converted their swords into plowshares, so to speak, and has made itself really a model for how a 21st century society can develop itself, can prosper, can create peace and prosperity partnerships with its neighbors, and do all that in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as possible. Now, I mentioned earlier that the key concept is going to be productivity and energy productivity, labor productivity, social productivity, healthcare productivity. And so I want to just give you a few examples of the types of institutions, because you have to have the right values where first you've decided, okay, we're going to create this broadly shared prosperity. But then you have to create the institutions that have incorporated those values that then enact that into policy. And unfortunately, in the United States, we don't have the right values right now or the right institutions as a result of that. But Europe has put these values into some institutions in the following way, looking at healthcare. In the United States, we all know the problems with healthcare. We're ranked 37th in the world by the World Health Organization. France is ranked first. Many of the other European countries are ranked in the top 10 in their healthcare. And yet we're spending about 17% of our GDP, of our gross domestic product, on healthcare compared to countries in Europe are spending 7, 8, 9%, some of them less than 7%. France is about the highest at about 11%. Basically, Americans are spending twice as much money per capita on health care, and yet all the health care indicators show that we have worse health than they do. So how has Europe managed to enact a different kind of health care system? You hear in the United States, the debate has boiled down to single payer or socialized medicine, as it's called, versus what we have now. And and Europe is written off as socialism. They have socialized medicine. And it's never going to work here. And in fact, most countries in Europe don't even have socialized medicine or single payer. We use Germany as the example. Germany has, as the backbone of its healthcare system, 200 private insurance companies. Private insurance companies, just like we have here in the United States. The doctors don't work for the state. The hospitals aren't funded by the state exclusively. It's 200 private insurance companies. But here's the key difference. In Germany, all those private insurance companies are nonprofits. In the United States, all the companies are healthcare corporations that are for-profit, CEOs making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And, I mean, think about it. The incentives of a for-profit insurance company are literally to jack up your rates as high as they can get away with, hence Anthem Blue Cross recently announcing an up to 40% increase in individual rates. There was an outcry over that, so they backed down a little bit. But that's what they want to do if they can get away with it. And then their second incentive is to give you as few services as possible, because every time they give you a service, that's money out of their pocket. It's not a question of being an evil healthcare corporation. Those are the incentives of a for-profit system. A nonprofit system doesn't have those incentives. And so as a result of that, you can do other things with your healthcare system that we can't do here. So, for example, what they do in Germany and France has this, Belgium, Switzerland, they all have – France doesn't have a socialized medical system. Socialized medicine you see in Britain, Canada, Sweden, some other countries, but not in France, Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, Austria. They have this system that I'm describing. So because you can have a nonprofit system, then you can do things like what they do is every year or 2 years, they pull together all the stakeholders in the system. So the doctors and nurses, representatives, healthcare professionals, the insurance companies, government representatives, consumer representatives, and they negotiate costs and fees for everything, kind of like what we do in healthcare, and that helps keep the cost down. If you go to a French doctor's office, they can hand you a menu of what they do and how much they charge. How many of you have had the experience I've had recently of getting my health care bill, and I look at that thing, and I can't even figure out what I had done. There's no code there. There's no nothing. You have to call them up, waste your time with a silly phone tree before you finally get someone online to even figure out what they're billing you for. There's no transparency built in. There's no nonprofit incentives built in. And that's why you can have situations like the book I have a few instances where I was visiting a friend of mine in southwest France, a small rural town, and she was stung by a hornet. It was painful, certainly not life-threatening. she, you know, did what she could. She said, well, I'll just call my doctor and see if there's anything else I should be doing for this because it really hurts. She calls up her doctor, and the doctor says, oh, I'm doing my rounds right now. I'll be over in 15 minutes. I thought, my God, a house call over a hornet sting? I mean, the United States house calls went out when Ozzie and Harriet was on television, right? And so these are the sorts of things you can do in a nonprofit healthcare system that you simply can't do in a for-profit system. You also can do things like having computerized databases where, in fact, Germany actually copied the VA administration system, where they have a huge database of everyone in Germany is in a nationwide database. So if they have a recall over a medicine, they can instantly alert everybody because it's not this hodgepodge decentralized system. They can do things like, they have what's called laptop medicine. Nurse comes into your hospital room. She has a barcode on her wrist. You have a barcode on. The medication has a barcode on. She scan it all, and it has to match. If it doesn't match, a sound goes off on the laptop saying, oops, something's wrong here. In the United States, up to 100,000 Americans die every year because of mistakes in hospitals in this, system in which we're paying twice as much money per capita. I could go on and on about healthcare, but that's just one example in which healthcare productivity in the United States has got to change. And Obama has started down the path. He's getting a lot of flack on it, but he's only taken a few baby steps. Because even if you introduce a large public option, you have to introduce enough nonprofit incentives into the market to affect the for-profit players. And the best way to do that, of course, would be to convert all of the insurance companies to nonprofits. Give you some other examples of the type of productivity we need to do. Let's talk about childcare, for example. In the United States, an average family with two children is paying $12,000 or more for childcare. In Europe, in some countries, it's free. In others, they're paying $1,000, maybe $2,000 for childcare. And they can do that because, again, they don't have these decentralized hodgepodge systems. They've decided to pool their money, creating pools of what they call social insurance. And by doing that, you can train people, you can make a professional workforce and things, something like childcare. And you can do it in a way where you get economies of scale and greater efficiencies built into your system that actually costs you less money as the consumer. Another example of the productivity that they're getting is in their economy. We'll use Germany as the example again. In many ways, Germany is the star, if you will, of my book because they're doing so many interesting things that we really should be learning from. And yet I find I've been giving talks all across the United States in connection with my book, and most Americans don't even know about these things. We have so many myths and stereotypes that are really holding us back. Germany has Fortune 500 companies, big corporations with names that you've probably heard of like Volkswagen and Mercedes, Siemens, major, major corporations, just like we have here. But in Germany, by law, the workers get to elect 50% of the board members of the board of directors of these major corporations. Think about that. It would be like, imagine if Walmart were required by law. See, we all chuckle when I say that because it's like, oh, God, you can't even imagine it. And yet, here you have the world's fourth largest economy, the world's largest exporter. Some people say China is a larger exporter now, but I don't trust China's numbers at all. One of the largest exporters, certainly in the world. And they by law, the workers get to elect 50% of the board members of major corporations. Imagine if Walmart had to allow its workers to elect 50% of its board members, or Google, or Microsoft, or Apple. That's what we're talking about here. And yet, how many people here had heard of it before? Few hands, not many. I mean, so much for our media and our education system that we in the United States don't even know. I mean, essentially what Germany and Europe has done is they've reinvented the corporation. I mean, you can read a lot of progressive and left writers like Noam Chomsky and Naomi Klein, and they really bash corporations as if all corporations are alike. And yet they are not alike. The corporations in Europe are quite different than here. They act differently. They have to because they have laws that make them act differently. In addition, they have in Germany and other places what's called works councils at every job site where the workers get to elect a council a representative council who has, and these are, this is in addition to the labor unions, which are also stronger because of better laws in Europe around labor unions. And those workers have tremendous say over things like scheduling and if there are going to be layoffs, how those layoffs will be conducted. And these have created much more of what I call a culture of consultation between labor and employers and corporations and the people who work in them. And that's why Germany, I mean, here in the United States, we've seen a more than doubling of our unemployment rate during this economic crisis, to the point where, you know, almost at 10% of unemployed and about 16, 17, 18% of, if you include the underemployed, people who want a full-time job but can't get one. In Germany, the unemployment rate has actually gone down. Now, how have they managed to do this? Because instead of laying off millions of workers like we've done here, they enacted something as a result of this culture of consultation. They enacted something that is called Kurzarbeit, or the translation is short work. They had, instead of laying off workers, they had workers cut back a little bit. So instead of working 100%, you're working, say, 90%. But during the good times, Germany was laying aside money so that if you're now working at 90%, you get 95% of your pay. By doing this, you do some other really good things. One, you keep your workforce intact so that when the recovery begins, you're ready to go. And now that the recovery has begun in Germany, in fact, the last quarter, they grew at a blistering 2.2%, which on an annualized rate is almost 9%. That's the growth rate that you expect in China and India. And so their workforce is ready to go. The other thing that you do is that you prevent the utter devastation that happens to families and communities when you lay off the breadwinners. You know, I mean, you have places like Stockton, California, where we're seeing 25-30% of homes in foreclosure because people can't pay their mortgages anymore. Increases in domestic violence, alcoholism, mental illness. These are the things that happen as a result of layoffs. And yet when Larry Summers, who's one of President Obama's closest economic advisors and who, along with Robert Rubin, is given credit for crafting this financial industry-dominated economy that has crashed and burned. And why Obama has him as one of his advisors, I don't know. But when he was asked about, look, this, why don't we do this German short work stuff? It seems to work pretty well. His response was, in America, we're not about protecting old jobs. We're about creating new jobs. As if there's some conflict between the two. I mean, and I think that really shows a key difference between Wall Street capitalism and social capitalism. Wall Street capitalism is very fundamentalist in nature. They adhere to some ideology about the free enterprise, even though if you were to accurately describe the American free enterprise system at this point, it's one where government and we, the taxpayers, had to bail out the banks and the auto companies. It's one where we've socialized the losses and privatized the gains. That's our free enterprise system, right? And in Europe, they're much more pragmatic about their capitalism. It's supposed to be there to help people. It's supposed to be there to take the wealth that's produced and create this more broadly shared prosperity. And whatever it takes to get the job done, that's what you do. And so we're just so hidebound. We're so stuck to the flypaper of old ideas here in the United States that we really are getting ourselves deeper and deeper into a hole in many, many ways. The other area in which productivity, and maybe I'll just end here so that we can, I want to have lots of time for your questions and I can fill in whatever you want to talk about the economic crisis and what have you. But the other area in which productivity, of course, is so, so important is in energy productivity because of global warming and what's going on. Of course, that's being pushed to the back burner as a result of this economic crisis. But the fact is that Europe, because they have been busy like bees implementing a lot of renewable technologies, conservation technologies, some of which were invented right here, and we haven't implemented. But they've been implementing them, and so as a result, they have what's called an ecological footprint that's half that of the United States for the same standard of living. Half. The average European emits half the carbon of the average American, uses half the electricity of the average American. It takes 40% more fuel to go a mile in an American car than it does in a European car. Europe is doing, some of what they've done is low-hanging fruit sort of stuff. Like, for example, these, you know, new low-wattage light bulbs where you can get the same wattage for a tenth of the power. Putting in place motion sensor lights, so when no one's in the room, the lights go off. Or motion sensing escalators, so when no one's using the escalator, it doesn't run anymore. It doesn't run until someone steps on the lip of the escalator, and then it takes off. I mean, look at downtown San Francisco at night sometime. It's lit up like a fireball, even though there's no one in those buildings. They could have motion sensor lights in all those buildings where you either shut the lights off completely or you can take them down to a certain level of dimness if there's some reason to have them on so that planes don't crash into them at night or something. I don't know. And yet here in a place like San Francisco where you think that we have a very progressive government, you know, progressive board of supervisors, progressive mayor, they've really done very little towards pushing both people who live here as well as the businesses that do business here into doing this kind of low-hanging fruit stuff. Europe is just far, far ahead of us in these ways. They've done it in government buildings, but I mean, you know, government buildings, there's not that many of them. You need to start pushing consumers as well as businesses to start really implementing these things. Europe has gone beyond that and doing some really, really wild things in certain ways. You know, for example, in terms of building design, they are way beyond the LEED design that we have in the U.S., which is a voluntary system for, you know, you figuring out if you have a green building or not. I mean, they're doing things like imagine building a building in which you drill, you put shafts into the ground until you reach a point underground where it's the same temperature year-round. And then you can pull that air up, and depending on the time of year, you can either heat it or cool it for very little amount of electricity. And they're creating these hermetically sealed buildings where they can completely control the amount of air going in and out. And so you can exchange, as the air is going out, you can exchange the heat in that air with the air coming in with 90% efficiency. You can heat buildings with the, homes and things with the amount of electricity it takes to run a hairdryer. These are sorts of things that they're doing. They're doing things like combined heat and power, CHP. When a power plant produces electricity, whether it's burning some fossil fuel or whatever source it's using, typically 60% of the fuel used to produce the electricity is lost up the flue of the stack through just heat. It's an extremely inefficient process. Well, what Europe is doing is they take that heat and they rechannel it and they put it into pipes and then they take it to homes and businesses and buildings where you can get 90% of efficiency instead of 40% efficiency. So these are all the sorts of clever things that they're doing and have been doing for a number of years. I mean, they haven't done this overnight. They've known for some time that they really need to reduce carbon emissions and decrease the amount of energy used, and they have been going at it. And then, of course, they've done renewable technology, solar, wind. Germany is the largest producer of solar and wind power in the world. Even though they don't have 80 million people, they produce far more than we do here with 300 million people. And they're doing amazing things with sea power. Imagine having these huge tubes floating in the ocean. They're about 100 meters long, so about 300 feet long. And they're about 20 feet in diameter. And you can connect them together and create these grids. And they just float in the ocean, bobbing the up and down of the waves, producing energy. And then they're connected to power lines that take that energy to the shore. They're doing this off the coast of Portugal. They're putting one in off the coast of Scotland. They're called sea snakes or energy eels. So these are the sorts of things that they're really going outside the box with. And I mentioned already that it takes less fuel. Their automobiles, of course, the high-speed trains that they have, on and on and on. They've been investing in these sorts of things for a number of years. And this is also good for the economy. It creates jobs. The green industry in Europe is creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, as well as businesses are able to lower their energy costs. So when they go out there to compete on the global markets, their costs are less because they're using less electricity. So these are the sorts of things that are going on. Again, going back to what I said earlier, productivity, labor productivity, energy productivity, social productivity. Do you have the values and the institutions to do more with less going forward? That's what we're going to be asked to do here in the United States. That's what other countries around the world, the advanced economies, are going to be asked to do as the Chinas and the Indias and the Brazils come up in the world. And the countries that can't do that are going to fall behind. That's the reality of the era that we live in. And that's where We really have to hope that that in the United States we can turn this big ship around from the current course that it's on, because it's not on the right course. So why don't I stop there? And one other thing I'll just mention very quickly that is important. Another important thing, because it busts another one of these stereotypes. Because one of the comebacks that you hear from Americans is like, yeah, okay, Europeans have all that, but they pay a lot more in taxes than we do in the United States, and no taxation without representation, Americans would never put up with that. Well, this is actually another myth as well. Because if you're an American paying escalating health care costs, if you're an American paying huge amounts for child care, if you're paying huge amounts for university education, American students graduate tens of thousands of dollars in debt. In some countries in Europe, university education is still free. And in others, they've introduced a small tuition. Americans pay a lot more out of pocket for senior care. Okay? So when you boil it all down, you can't just look at what do you pay through taxes or whatever. You have to look at what do you get. And the fact is that Americans are paying out a lot more out of pocket to get the same things that Europeans get in exchange for their taxes. And so when you look at things like Forbes Tax Misery Index, which is, you know, one of the authoritative sources supposedly on taxes in the world, and you look at their index, of course you see the Europeans up there at the top. They're the most tax miserable, right? And they're down there, happy as a clam, around Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines is the United States. Well, that's because they're only looking at income tax, Social Security tax, and sales tax or VAT. They're not looking at who's paying what out of pocket. And so the only way, as an American ideologue, that you can square this circle is that you say, well, okay, that's all well and good, but at least in America, you don't have to get them if you don't want to. The government's not taking the money out of your pocket, which is a degree of truth too. But the reality is, I ask you to consider, in the world we live in today, with the increasing amount of insecurity that we all are going to be living with going forward, do you not need health care? Do you not need some sort of retirement waiting for you? Or childcare, or some sort of university education or training? Are these things really discretionary, as the ideologues would tell you that they are? Or are these some things that we really need? And what Europeans are showing is that by pooling your money and creating these pockets of social insurance, you can produce all these things for a lot less money, with a lot more efficiency, more productivity. And what our system shows is that these decentralized, hodgepodge, buy them if you want systems are really expensive, because you can't get economies of scale. So these are the things that that we have to really consider as we go forward. So let's open it up. Thank you. And I should say there's a website for the book, if anybody wants to check out some of this stuff, which is just www.europespromise.org.
Our thanks to Stephen Hill, author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. We'll now be open to audience questions. And if you'd like to come up to the microphone here and ask your question, so it will be part of the recorded broadcast, that would be very helpful.
And as you come up, I should say that I have three chapters in the book that really that look at some of the challenges of Europe around things like immigration, population decline in certain countries, and getting more women in the workforce. So, you know, I don't at all take the view that Europe's got it all made and, isn't life grand in Europe. They have their challenges as well, especially in the aftermath of this economic crisis. I know we can talk about those during the Q&A for anyone who's interested.
First of all, let me warn you that I am schizophrenic, at least by your definition. I am an economist. I did foresee the housing bubble. I called it, and as a result, I did lose a job.
What does that tell you about your profession?
No, it tells me a lot about Wall Street and other things, which I could go into, but I... You know, I generally agree with you. I find your talk a little bit polemic in nature, first in the work I have done, which is a little bit outdated, I still believe that productivity is a very difficult thing to measure. But I still believe that U.S. productivity does exceed that of European productivity.
I'm using productivity in a more, you're using it in the classical
economics. I'm using it very much in a classical.
In a more of a generic sense about learning to do more with less. There's no question that you American workers have high productivity. The question is, the real challenge is that, unfortunately, that productivity has not produced wealth that has gone into Americans' pockets because we've seen a decline in income for the last three decades.
Well, I think it's largely been stable in terms of real terms, but certainly if you look at our things like the Gini coefficient, income distribution has been badly become horrible in this country.
Absolutely.
Over the past decade. So there's no, I won't debate you on that point. Your question, though, talking about social capitalism in Europe versus Wall Street capitalism, I did spend a fair amount of my career as a Wall Street equity analyst, and I covered European companies, Diageo, Unilever, BP, I can go on. And, you know, the problem is there when I talk to their executives and I look at their behavior, I don't see a lot of difference between what they do and what is done in the U.S. The constraints that have been put on them, at least in some countries, and I certainly, UK may be, post-Thatcher may be, or Thatcher and after, may be a lot different from the rest, Central Europe, but I don't see anything there. Point, it's just something I'm tossing out as a question, is health care, which this country really sucks at. But what has always struck me of interest is who's paying for that. Most people in this room, I'm not going to guess your average age, but most people here are not directly paying for their insurance. Their companies and our employers are paying for it. It's Wall Street, and always questions me why Wall Street itself, to its own benefit, has not cracked down on these and what sort of feedbacks go there. When I was on Wall Street, we didn't like our suppliers a whole lot.
Great, thanks.
Final question I want to bring up, and this is really the critical question I have, is you said values are different, and that is the real problem we face here. Our values, at least as we perceive them, are different from those of the Europeans, and to achieve what you want to achieve, which I would like to see happen, requires a change in our values. And how do we bring back, how do you achieve that? Because values are something that drives the economy first.
Sure. Well, in the United States, we have different strains of values. The values that came out of the Reagan administration, for example, were much different than the values that came out of the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. So we do have a tradition in the United States of trusting government to be a more involved player in making sure the economy works and making sure that Americans enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What happened was in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan, remember in the first inaugural address, he said government is the problem. And Bill Clinton, in order to win re-election in 1996, came along and said the era of big government is over. So at that point, the Democrats had signed up for Reaganism. There was no party, political party, to really defend not big government, but just smart government. Government has a unique ability to bring people together over shared values and goals and policies. No one else can really do it like government. It doesn't mean that government always does good things. I'm not someone that just thinks government is good and business is bad. Both have their good points and bad points. Clearly business has done some good things in the United States, helping to build up a wealth. But look what the mess we're in right now because of some businesses that got overly greedy and because government was pulled back to the point where there was no oversight over these very greedy businesses. And so I think now is an important time to be pulling forward these values that came from the New Deal and that came from other points in our history in which we had a different view of government. I mean, in some ways, you know, obviously President Obama inherited a heck of a mess. But one of my biggest disappointments with President Obama is that he has not managed to – he has not figured out how to transform the conversation about government. In fact, the whole Tea Party movement shows that that these same toxic trends in the United States that go back to Reaganism in the modern era are still there and alive and strong. And that, you know, there has to be some way – I mean, when you have someone who's saying, get government out of my Medicare, right, as one Tea Party person said, that's a clear sign that you're in a delusional situation. And unfortunately, that is where we are in many ways. And so we have to really transform this conversation in a way that recognizes – the positives that government can do, the positives that business can do, and what kind of partnership we can have between these different sectors of our economy to create more of a social capitalism.
Well, I'm an engineer. I'm not an economist, so I'm actually just going to ask you an economist question. Been looking at personal income tax income tax here in the U.S. versus a lot of places in Europe necessarily. And you see that we supposedly have a lower income tax here, but when you start looking at payroll tax or personal employment tax, and there's another 20% you have to add on top of whatever you're paying as soon as you get the money in your pocket, right? So when you start adding up all those other taxes there that we don't usually see unless you're employed, unless you're privately employed, then it seems like we're the higher income levels are definitely over 50%. Lower income levels are definitely in the 35-40% range. So at that rate, doesn't it? It seems to me that we're actually paying more in taxes than most European countries. Just kind of want to get your thoughts.
Well, it depends on the country. Some countries, the amount you're paying in the Netherlands and others really is higher than here. But other countries in Europe, it actually isn't higher because of the reasons you say. And I rather than parsing what each country pays, which it's hard to keep track of, they're changing all the time, I chose to make the larger point that regardless of what tax rates you're paying, there's an outstanding question there of what are you getting for that, and is it sufficient, or do you have to supplement that with an exorbitant amount of out-of-pocket payments? I'll give you one example. I just wrote a report for my previous organization, the New America Foundation, about Social Security. And what's happening to Social Security? Think about the debate that's happening right now. You have some are saying that we need to cut Social Security in order to reduce our indebtedness and that it's not going to be sustainable over a certain number of years and all these sorts of things, which, of course, is not true. The Connecticut Congressional Budget Office has said that Social Security is secure through 2037. And then the other side of the debate is preserve what we have, keep the status quo. Well, here's the reality. In the post-World War II period, the American retirement system depended on what was called the three-legged stool of retirement. The three legs were company pensions, private savings, which was mostly centered around home ownership, and Social Security. Those were the three legs, and they provided the stability of the stool to have a decent retirement system for Americans. Well, even before the Great Recession, companies were walking away from company pensions. In fact, at this point, only 10% of private employers provide a company pension. Most pensions today are through the public sector, through governments, and these governments at local and state levels at this point have huge amounts of debt that if you had to pay all of the obligations you had of your pensions right now today, they would every government, including the federal government, would be bankrupt. They're not necessarily sustainable. So pensions, one of the stools is basically gone. The second stool, private savings, especially as I mentioned earlier, American workers produce a heck of a lot, but the wealth has not gone into their pockets in terms of income. For three decades, incomes have been declining in the United States. And that's why more and more Americans had to borrow in order to maintain their level of the standard of living that they had, in the 60s and 70s. And so as they built up this astronomical debt, including, in their housing, This became very vulnerable, we now realize, when the housing market crashed. So at this point, the second leg is no one right now, that any of the economists I talk to think that the housing market is going to come back anytime soon. And a lot of Americans who had a big part of their retirement in their housing, they lost 40%, took a haircut of 40% when their housing values plummeted. There are about 30% of Americans at this point are underwater. Their houses are worth less than their mortgage. If they were to sell their house today, they would have to take a loan out in order to pay off the loan they have. So basically, the American retirement system is left with a one-legged stool, Social Security. Now, here's the thing about Social Security. If you retire, it's going to pay about 33 to 40% of your last income. That's not enough to live on. Compare that to a country like Germany, where you're going to get 70% of your last income. France, 75% of your last income. So we're stuck in a situation where we have this one-legged stool that doesn't pay enough. So that means, you know, for those of you who retired now, congratulations, you are the best generation of retirees America is ever going to see. At this point, it's just steadily downhill because the three-legged stool is now a one-legged stool, and that one leg is too short by half. So this is what we're facing, and yet the debate that's going on right now, so-called, doesn't acknowledge any of this. And so Americans are going to have to pay a lot more money out of pocket for your retirement going forward, and there's just no question about it. And, you know, Europeans have a better national retirement system. I mean, Social Security has become – it was always supposed to be a supplement to your own private savings and a company pension. It has become a de facto national retirement system, and yet it doesn't pay nearly enough money to play that role.
Go ahead. Well, following up on your last comments, recognizing that certainly in Western Europe, the societies there are aging at a more rapid rate than we are here in the United States, and given the richer benefits, both in terms of retirement benefits and their senior care systems, which I personally is very envious of, having worked in the field of aging for over 35 years in this state. Do you think the European political systems are going to be able to respond to this aging of their societies and having to make adjustments in those systems and still be able to sustain the core retirement benefits, senior care benefits, and other social benefits they provide, given the aging of their societies?
Yes, this is a very good question, and I have a whole chapter in the book about this, because this is one of the real challenges that Europe faces going forward. Are they going to be able to afford what they have? A couple of myths to clear up about it. It's not true that all European countries have this aging population problem, have declining population, which is the other flip side of the aging population. The three countries that have it the worst are Spain, Italy, and Germany. And interestingly, those are all three formerly fascist countries where there were these cults of motherhood around during Franco and Hitler and Mussolini, in which they basically said women shouldn't work, women shouldn't be in the workforce, women should be the baby producers and take care of the home and the hearth kind of thing. And it's interesting that in a country like Germany, which is progressive in so many ways, you still see vestiges of these attitudes that have led to a lower than average for Europe and for the United States number of women in the workforce, lower than average number of child care centers, with a first woman chancellor, Angela Merkel, now the leader of Germany. She has taken some big steps to triple the number of child care centers and all these sorts of things. And so assuming there's a solution for Europe, the solution is going to be making it possible, especially in these three countries, for women to not have to choose between having a career or having a family. Because there's all sorts of evidence showing that if you make women choose between one or the other, that more women are choosing to have a career instead of a family. So if you have the support system around the family, and they're starting to do things like actually paying when you have a child. I mean, all across Europe, when you have a child, in Germany, for example, you receive $200 a month for that child to pay for things like diapers and baby formula or whatever you need for that baby. In some countries like France, I mean, for example, in France, there's a lot of evidence that France is at the cusp, but not really having much population decline just a little bit. But it's because there are enough women having one and two children, but there are fewer women today having three and four children, fewer larger families. So they're paying more money trying to create more incentives for that third and fourth child. Whether that's going to work, it's hard to say. But, the interesting thing is that, in fact, I have a quote in the book from a New York Times writer who writes about motherhood issues a lot. And she spent a couple of years in France as a mother and it came back to U.S. as a mother. And she said it's, the amount of support you have in a place like France as a mother is just night and day compared to what you have here in the United States. And so that's the type of thing that that I think we need to look at. The other issue around can they afford this is what's called the dependency ratio. How many workers do you have for how many non-workers? Non-workers being retired people, people who can't work for reasons of infirmity or children. And the ratio now is about 4-1. But if these trends continue, it's going to go down to 2-1. And the fear is that when it gets too low, they won't be able to afford it anymore. But that's all related to the issue of labor productivity, which we've talked about a little bit. Because in the 1960s, the dependency ratio was 18-1. And the decline from 18-1 to 4-1, which has gone on from the 60s till today, is a much greater decline than from 4-1 to 2-1. And yet Europe has prospered and become even wealthier because they've had higher labor productivity. So the pieces are there to deal with this. Whether or not they will, everyone's got their crystal ball out trying to figure these things out. I don't pretend to know what the answer is. I came away convinced that Europe understands they have a problem. They understand what the potential solutions are, and they're taking steps to implement these solutions.
I just wanted you to comment perhaps on an item that had been in the paper quite a bit the last couple of weeks, and that is about the strikes in France and England. I know in France the issue is the fact they want to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62.
60 to 62, right.
The articles also said Germany's retirement age is 67.
It will be. It's not yet, but that's where they're going.
That's where they're going. Same as the United States.
Right.
So that strikes me as a major change in the retirement system in Europe, and I wondered what your how you felt what the outlook was for that sort of thing, and whether are these strikes just for show? I mean,
oh no, they're serious.
But we hear
these strikes are serious.
But we hear about them all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
who wins? But it's not just France. As you say, it's Britain, it's Greece, it's
there's 1 year in France.
When you're
they
used
were
to
shutting things down every single day, one union after another in
right.
Paris, I remember, and you kind of wonder, well, they do their thing, and then
right.
and then the government gets to go ahead and do whatever they wanted to do. Is that the case or not?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a case of what you're used to. I certainly look at that and I think the French, I think, like, come on, guys. I mean, you're retiring at 60. I mean, is 62 really that bad? I find myself saying that a little bit. But from the French point of view, it is that bad because that's what they have been used to. And so they're afraid of, the slippery slope. I'll give you another example. In the Czech Republic, the government wanted to introduce a $2 copayment for their health care every time you went to the doctor. And there were riots in the streets. Because in the Czech Republic, there's a tradition of health care is not a privilege, it's a right. And once you start making anybody pay any amount, you've crossed a line that they're afraid, it's $2 this year, $5 next year, then it's $10, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not willing to go down that line. Here's the thing that strikes me. To be perfectly honest, I don't fault people in France and Britain and Greece and elsewhere who are out on the streets for fighting things, even when I think, like, geez, maybe they're being a little unreasonable. I wonder why more Americans aren't out on the streets. I mean, where is the anger in California where, as I said, early this year, there was a report issued that 25% of Californians do not have health care. In Greece, even the problems where they're going through, everyone still has health care and they have access to, child care and lots of other things that just Californians don't have and don't even think they deserve. And this is, again, comes back to, Americans have gotten so used to thinking that government is incompetent and we don't deserve anything. We don't deserve longer vacations. What would I do with that time? Well, you could spend more time with your family, for heaven's sakes. Spend more time relaxing. In fact, there's a lot of studies showing that well-rested workers are actually more productive workers. And yet the United States is one of the few countries in the world that does not have national paid mandatory holidays. There are Americans working full-time jobs that do not have any days off per year. We also are one of the few countries in the world that does not have mandatory paid sick leave. And so you have about 60 million private sector workers in the United States that do not have paid sick leave. A lot of them work in restaurants. They're handling your food. And when they're sick, they're faced with the choice of, do I stay home and basically self-subsidize my sick leave, or do I go to work, show up, and potentially infect all my coworkers and the customers who eat our food? I mean, even just from the, you know, I would think from a conservative economic standpoint, this makes no sense. And yet, this is how things are in the United States, not to mention no paid parental leave and all these sorts of things. So, you know, I mean, I have a lot of friends in Europe, and I listen to them, you know, talking about the cutbacks that are happening, and they're, you know, there's an article in the paper talking about how in Italy they're going to lose one of their weeks of vacation in August, it looks like. And I thought, well, you know, they still have in the rest of August more vacation than just about than most Americans have for the entire year, not to mention what they get for the rest of the year. And so, you know, when you read some of you to realize when you read about cutbacks in Europe thing, and they are cutting back to some degree, they're being cut back to a point that is still far more than what we have here in the United States. And the media is another player in this that really has gotten Europe wrong, just as they missed weapons of mass destruction. Just as they missed an $8 trillion housing bubble, they have missed what's going on in Europe. In fact, in my book, I have read you. I collect all these headlines from 2003-2006 period in which the American media was reporting on the weak, sclerotic economy in Europe. And they, you know, so headlines like "The End of Europe," "Europe Isn't Working," "Will Europe Ever Work?" "What's Wrong with Europe?" "The Decline and Fall of Europe," "Old Europe Unprepared for New Battles," "Western Europe is Cursed," "Reforms in Europe Needed," "Is Europe Dying?" "The Rise of the Fortress Continent." That one was from The Nation, by the way. "The Decline of France," "Political Crisis Paralyzing Europe," "Europe's Long Vacation is Ending," "Why America Outpaces Europe," and "Europe Turns Back the Clock." The important thing about those headlines is that during that period, 2003 to 2006, in actual fact, Europe was in the process of passing the United States in the fast lane economically in terms of job creation, productivity, all these sorts of things. In fact, there was an article that appeared in October 2006 in Newsweek International, a cover story. It said something like, "Europe, great jobs machine outpacing America." That article never appeared in Newsweek Domestic. So Americans are not learning about what's going on in Europe. And because we're not learning about what's going on in Europe, we can't understand what's happening to us. And instead, we're hearing a lot of hype about China and China as the next emerging superpower, which, is from my point of view, is just ridiculous. I mean, China has done a lot in the last two decades in terms of building up from where they were during the abject poverty of the Mao years. But, when you're in China, traveling from the rural areas to the cities is like a form of time travel. You have, in the rural areas, they're still plowing fields with water buffalo, and people don't have very much. In the cities, you meet young people working in factories or young women working in bars and things who are, sleeping two to a bed, four to a bedroom. Life is a struggle. And yet all they're focusing on is, wow, China, they got that 10% growth rate. Isn't that amazing? And what you realize is that China is the place where Western prospectors go prospecting for gold, hoping to get rich because there is a lot of growth there. But in fact, China is not doing nearly as much to take care of its people as a place like Europe or Japan. And yet Europe and Japan are losing out in the public relations battle to China about, in the American media, when you read the American media. It's really mind-boggling to think of.
We're really about out of time, but maybe if we could do a really lightning question.
Oh, sure. Lightning rod.
I know the three of you have been standing here patiently.
Sorry if I went on too long on that one.
Okay, I've got two really quick questions. The first one is, what would you say is the root cause for the difference between the way Europe does things in the U.S.? Like, is it primarily cultural? When did it emerge? And, would you have been able to write this book 20 or 30 years ago? And my second question is, Just for the contrary perspective, what do you think the U.S., the Europe could learn from the U.S.?
Go ahead. Next.
My question was about looking at it kind of from the opposite, or perhaps doing a forecast. We keep hearing in the media that it looks like the U.S. government is probably going to change, that it's going to go a little more conservative with the November elections and going forward. What would you anticipate would happen, and have you seen anything in your travels and studies to indicate what is likely to happen? How much worse, by comparison to Europe's system, will we be if a strong conservative takeover does occur in Congress and perhaps in 2012 the presidency?
Okay.
I actually work for the French government. So,
in what capacity?
In economic development, so helping U.S. companies set up operations over there. So I really understand this problem, and I get drilled about it every day with U.S. corporations.
Are you French or American?
American.
Okay.
And but I've lived in France for 4 years and married to a Frenchman, so I understand fully both sides. And my question is, well, it's more my theory, is that I understand that it comes down to social values, and I would rather my neighbor have access to higher education, but that's just me. So is it maybe easier in your point of view that nations are governed when they're smaller? Is that maybe an asset that Europe has because they're dealing with populations of 60 million and not the size of the U.S.?
Okay.
It's easier to divine social values and
right.
set up laws around social values when it's a smaller population.
All right. So I'll just run through these quickly. First, in terms of what Europe can learn from the U.S., Europe, I think, actually already has learned a lot from the U.S. In the 2000s, you saw a lot in efforts in Europe at increasing competitiveness, making it easier to lay off people. In Germany, they passed these reforms where they went from having – you'd have 2 years of unemployment to only a year, which is still twice as much as what you get in the United States, so a good example of the type of cutbacks that go on. So they already did a lot of things to try and make their economies more competitive. They also, when it comes to immigration, which we haven't even had a chance to really talk about, Europe, I think, is learning to some degree from the United States in terms of integration, integrating their societies. Not that we have in any way mastered that ourselves, but we just have been doing it a lot longer, so they can look at things like affirmative action programs, how have they worked, and how do you put money behind some of the efforts that are needed. I think that Europeans don't have they admire Americans in many ways. They really look up to us, in part because of our role in World War II. After World War II, we didn't enact vengeance. We enacted markets. We passed the Marshall Plan. They really admire that, and they see that as, in some ways, the magnificent act of a conquering power that set the tone for the decades since. And so, that's one of the things I think is really a tragic, is that Americans can't figure out some way to value more what Europe does and what has to offer us, because Europeans are learning from us. They've created more of a green industry. Some of the technology has been developed here. Europe has taken them and implemented them in much more widespread fashion. So they're taking our technologies and learning from us in that way as well. In terms of some of the root cause, some of it is in terms of the modern era, was what I mentioned earlier. Europe went through two world wars. The continent was utterly destroyed. They knew they had to do something different. They couldn't continue being these military warring machines that they had been for centuries. Or at least there was, something flipped there. Because after World War I, obviously, it didn't happen. They geared up and fought World War II. After two wars like that, something flipped, and they said, we've got to do it differently. As I mentioned, it was the conservative politicians in Europe that made this decision. So at that point, they had a European consensus. In the United States, we are still spending huge amounts of money on our military budget. I'm sure you all have seen the figures. We spend as much as the next 16 or 17 nations combined. Perhaps in the era of the Cold War, it was somewhat justified. But since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you have to ask yourself, who is the enemy today? Is it Iran? Well, Iran has a GDP the size of New Jersey's. Is it Afghanistan? Afghanistan has a GDP that's a third of Rhode Island's. And yet we can't figure out a way to help that situation without spending $1 trillion, $2-3 trillion, depending on whose figures you use, in the theaters of war that we've done, not to mention that we now have the biggest defense budgets that we've ever had. Obama signed the biggest defense budget, bigger than Bush's defense budget. It seems to me that we could be secure as a nation by spending a lot less money and putting that money into other things. And yet we haven't come to that consciousness yet. Why? Well, I mean, for example, we're still building weapon systems that military experts will tell you are geared to fight the Imperial Navy of Japan. You know, it's geared to fight World War II, not the current threats. Why are we still building them? Because they're built in some member of Congress's district. And we have to face the fact that at this point, our military budget is a jobs program. Our economy has become what Republican President Dwight Eisenhower warned that it would become hooked to an ongoing fiscal stimulus from defense spending. And unhooking from that is going to be difficult. And yet all sorts of studies show that in terms of the multiplier effect, if you put that money into spending on infrastructure, which the Army Corps of Engineers, no liberal group, has said we're $3 trillion behind in our infrastructure maintenance. And so if we put that money into that kind of infrastructure spending, we could still provide more jobs. You get a bigger multiplier effect because you're spending it domestically. I mean, soldiers stationed around the world don't spend the money here. They spend it somewhere else. So and just from an economic standpoint, these things don't make sense, and yet we haven't yet reached that point of consciousness to make the leap. In terms of, there's also more historical things going back to the 18th century. I have a chapter in the book looking at the 18th century roots of our individualist approach to the European, more communitarian approach based on different strains of Christian religion. And so that you might find of interest if you want to read more about that. Conservative takeover. It's really hard to know what to everyone's wondering what's going to happen. I don't pretend to know what's going to happen this November. It certainly looks like the Democrats are going to lose some seats, whether they'll lose their majorities. It's hard to say. But regardless of which party is in power, it's been hard for Obama to really do much when you need 60 out of 100 votes in the United States Senate. We have this filibuster gone wild Senate. No one knew that you needed a supermajority to get anything done in the Senate until the Republicans decided to just stonewall everything. There's no other legislature in the world I'm familiar with that where you need a supermajority except for where? California. And what has it led to? Paralysis, inaction, failure to deal with the problems. You're seeing the same thing at the federal level. So the supermajority has got to go, regardless of which party is in power. It's, needing 60 out of 100 votes is anti-majoritarian, it's anti-democratic, and it has to go. Interesting question about whether if we were smaller, would that make a difference? Certainly if you talk to the Europeans right now who have been going through some of the upheaval over the formation of the European Union and the Eurozone, they would tell you that they wish that the bigness of the European Union was better worked out. I mean, it's simply the case that the Eurozone is only the current configuration of the European Union, 27 nations, only dates to 2004, and the euro only dates to 2001. So it's very young in formation. In fact, looking at Europe, it's like looking at the United States in the 1780s. From the time of the first government that we had in 1789, it really took about 80 years for the United States to cease being a collection of regions. And in fact, it took a civil war to unite us into a nation. And during that 80 years, we had about 7 or 8, depending on how you count them, financial panics or bank crises. So what Europe is going through right now is really not that unusual for an entity that's in formation like it. And, having economies of scale like we have in the United States, for example, allows someone who lost their job in Massachusetts to go to California to work, or someone who loses their job in Michigan to go to Texas to work. And that's a much That's an advantage to your economy. Some of my German friends were saying, like, oh, all the young people are leaving Germany. It's just horrible. And I said, well, where are they going to? Austria and Switzerland. I said, well, that's like moving from, San Francisco to Los Angeles. I mean, that's not a crisis. The same with in Greece right now. I mean, one of the problems has got solutions to problem in Greece has got to be Greek. If their economy doesn't have enough jobs right now, they've got to move elsewhere. But because of language barriers and other things, those sorts of challenges are going to take some time to work out, just like they used to take a much more effort to work out here in the United States. So I think more than the smallness or largeness, it's the time scale that's really the issue here. I mean, as humans, we're used to, things changing in our lives in the order of days or weeks, maybe months, maybe years. Society has changed on the order of decades. And so it's really easy to get thrown by the latest headline saying a crisis is occurring. But think about the headlines back in February, March, April about Greece. They said Europe was going down. Greece was going to have to leave the Eurozone, was going to have to maybe leave the EU. It was going to drag down all of – it was going to – contagion was going to spread to Italy, Spain, Ireland, Portugal. That was going to drag down all of Europe. Then Europe was going to drag down all of the United States. I mean, they had the dominoes all worked out. That's what the headlines were telling us. Now we just had a month in which Europe had an annualized rate of 4% growth compared to, about 2.5% here. It looks like in many ways Europe, especially Northern Europe, is doing better than we are. So it's just a way of saying, when you read those headlines, hopefully, if you get a copy of the book or remember some of what I said, take them with a grain of salt because they're trying to sell papers, I guess, or grab viewers. And so they tend to go with these sensationalist headlines. And the real challenge that we all face going forward is seeing the longer term trajectories and seeing what do we need to do here in the United States to position ourselves for the 21st century. And, it was in that spirit that I wrote this book, Europe's Promise, and hopefully it will help people to think through some of these issues. And I thank you for coming. It's been really a great pleasure of mine to talk to you tonight. Thank you.
Our thanks to Stephen Hill, author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age, for his fascinating talk. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating its second century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Mr. Hill will be signing copies of his book.
You're supposed to bang your gavel.